Welcome to Mysterious Goings On, the podcast about creativity, writing, and mystery. Every week, we talk about all kinds of great fiction and meet the people who write it. We also feature explorations about creativity in all walks of life. Your host, Alex Greenwood, will join you right after this.
Today on the show, we have the extraordinary Richard Sparks, a name synonymous with comedy and creativity in the entertainment industry. Having collaborated with titans such as Placido Domingo, Rowan Atkinson, and John Cleese, Richard's career is nothing short of legendary. But beyond the laughter and applause, Richard harbors a passion for the fantastical realms of fantasy fiction, inspired by his nocturnal adventures in online gaming. His latest novel, New Rock, New Role, is a testament to this passion, weaving the tale of a retired teacher whose foray into the world of online gaming catapults him into an unexpected journey of self-discovery and adventure. Richard Sparks, all seriousness aside, it's an honor to have you here. Welcome to Mysterious Goings On.
Well, thank you for having me, Alex. What a very flattering introduction.
Well, I probably damned you with faint praise there. You have so much in your CV, but we only have a little bit of time with you, so I'll get right to it. But thank you for joining us. I have to do this, Richard. I know you're getting this a lot, but I'm a huge, I'm a big Rowan Atkinson fan. I don't know where that puts me with you, but I hope that's in good stead.
Oh, absolutely.
I just never dreamed in my wildest dreams that I would meet the author of the hilarious Schoolmaster sketch from The Secret Policeman's Ball. It's just one of those weird things about the internet and podcasting where you just never dream you'd meet the gentleman who put that hilarious sketch together that also put Rowan Atkinson on the road to stardom.
It was a fun time. We were both very, very young. And it had come about from a small review that had been done in the Hampstead Theatre the year before, which I wrote for I wrote with my friend who was in it, Peter Wilson, now sadly dead, and his Elspeth Walker, his wife at the time, was in it, and also Rowan, the three of them. The show was built around Rowan, and Rowan had a perfectly competent writing partner, a man named Richard Curtis. I don't know if you've ever heard of him.
I've heard tell, yes.
So they were a team, and Peter and I were a team, and they're both, Rowan and Richard, are both delightful people. We hit it off the moment we met. In fact, we met him in Edinburgh when Peter and I were doing a two-man stage show on my summer holidays from my first job. And Peter was the funny one. I was the straight man. So I did the writing. And all the Oxford Review people came to support us because we'd left Oxford a year or two earlier. And afterwards, I met some of them. And one of them said, oh, you should meet this guy. And so standing at the back was a sort of rather lugubrious-looking Rowan Atkinson and introduced myself. And this is true. He said, I don't know why people like us are bothering to do reviews when people like you are doing shows like this. So I naturally thought, well, what a modest young man. How very blah, blah, blah. So then Peter and I went to see their show to support them a day or two later. And there was one point where Rowan came on with a torn bit of paper and tried to give it to the audience, making funny faces and going, blah, blah, blah. And the audience didn't know what to think, you know. Right. And Peter and I turned to each other like this. We went, jaws dropping open. We go, that's the real thing. I mean, just astonishing. And everyone was saying he's the new Peter Sellers, but I actually think his career's more varied than Peter Sellers. If you look at Blackadder and Mr. Bean, he's just an extraordinary talent and he works really hard at it. So when he was asked to do the show, they asked Peter and Elspeth to be in it. And one day, I had a bit of a hangover that morning for some reason. I woke up in my house, in my room in Brixton, in a friend's house, and thought I'd better write something for the new guy. I can't just write for my friend. So I started writing a list of names that got sillier and sillier, and then realized this was going somewhere, but where? I thought, oh, this needs a sketch to, oh, he's the schoolmaster doing a roll call. And then the sketch followed, and I typed it up. I still have the manuscript at home in London. I typed it up, handed the typescript to Rowan that morning in rehearsal, and he sort of looked at it and went, and wandered off. And I thought, well, that's, for the first one I'd given him, I thought, well, that's a good result. He didn't say no, not for me. And then the first time he did it in rehearsal, he just filled an empty theatre with Invisible Schoolboys. I think there's just me and the director in there. I don't know if Richard was there that moment, Curtis, or whether any of my castmates were watching. I just remember he took it extremely slowly, which I hadn't thought, and ate it alive. And I thought, oh, this is fun. And then John Cleese, and the show wasn't very good, in all honesty. You can check the reviews if you like. But John Cleese and Martin Lewis, the producers of Not the Nine, excuse me, of The Secret Policeman's Ball, came and saw it. And then a year later, Rowan called me up. By then, I'd actually bought my first house in London, and I was in the paint spattered overalls, you know. And he said, John Cleese just rang, and he's doing a new charity show, and he's asked me to be in it, and can I do the schoolmaster? So I said, yeah, of course, you know, no. So we met in a pub called the Captain's Cabin, which I think is on Haymarket or St James's. Don't know if it's still there. And walked down to Her Majesty's Theatre and in through the stage door, you know, where all the stars go. And all the stars were in there. There was Pete Townshend and Billy Connolly just, you know, hanging about or on stage. I mean, Pete Townshend from The Who and various Pythons and John Cleese. And Rowan introduced me to John and said, this is Richard who wrote it. And John, this is the difference between a funny writer and a funny person. John Cleese said to me, your face looks familiar, you know, holding his hand out, looking down at me. He's about a foot taller than me. And I said, off the top of my head, it's not very funny when I repeat it, but at the time it kind of worked. I said, well, I could usually pick it out 9 times out of 10 in a not too crowded mirror. And he looked at me and he went, ah, and his laugh made me laugh more than my quip made him laugh, because he's a funny guy. Rowan off stage actually isn't. He's just, you know, rather sit in the back of the car and be normal. And he loves driving heavy goods vehicles and cars. And he's, you know, he probably shouldn't tell this story because I guess it's a didn't have a license, but he was looking for somewhere to live, and friends of Elspeth, who was in the show with him, they, oh, we got a spare apartment, which I think he shared with Richard Curtis for a bit, and he couldn't afford the rent. Now, Rowan was an electrical engineer. He did an MSc at Oxford in electrical engineering or electrical something. And so to pay the rent, he rewired the house for them. It was perfect little curves and turns and, you know, much neater than any electrician. That's the kind of guy. And that's a bit like having a Harrison Ford kitchen in Hollywood, isn't it?
Yeah, being the carpenter.
Yeah.
Because I had read that Rowan, just to your point, well, I promise we can stop fanboying you
Oh,
here. But
I love Brand bits.
okay, but I heard that he often got after Richard during Blackadder, saying, you know, the dialogue is so. Well, when I watch The Schoolmaster, and I think about Blackadder and all his iterations. Well, except for the first season where he was a twit, but after that, when he was so quick with the glib line, and the delivery is really what made everything, you know. Like you know, you could say something to me and I could say, oh, shame. Well, but he say, oh, shame, and it was perfect. But I read that he would often get after Richard and say, you know, because I think he stammered a little or something. I don't really recall, but he was getting after him about some of the language and just trying to get it right and all
Really?
that. He was very
Well, I didn't.
perfectionistic.
Yeah, well, he works extremely hard. I mean, I had a drink with John Lloyd, the producer of that, and Not the 9 o'clock News, and QI, and the Museum of Curiosity, and just about, oh, Spitting Image, for heaven's sake. He's the leading producer of our generation. And he said, oh, yeah, Rowan fired me 5 times. He always came back, because then eventually there was nobody there to tell him what to do, because he just, you know, got rid of the. But he's a delightful chap, Rowan. And I'm very, it's kind of an honor to have been there at the time.
Yeah.
And to have done that one piece. And, you know, honestly, look, I got a drawer full of old scripts that have been forgotten. And if it hadn't been Rowan doing it, it would be in the drawer with the rest of them. His performance, you know, he's a perfect example of what Chekhov said. I write one thing, the actor writes another thing, together we make a show. Rowan didn't change a word. I think he did add a line in rehearsal, which is really good. I can't remember. He had a good idea. Well, that often happens with scripts.
Sure. Yeah.
And, you know, so his interpretation, he was once asked, you know, where does this character come from? And he said, well, I think I must have based it on various character, you know, schoolmasters I had at school. My first reaction was, it came from the bloody writer. What do you think? But then, of course, he has to base his interpretation is based on his observations and his decisions and his mood and how, you know, the mood of the character. So my words and his what's the word I'm looking for? Creativity It's not just interpretation. That together created the show. And he really is remarkable. I could go on about and bang on about Douglas Adams if you want next. But
Oh, Douglas Adams.
Douglas was John Lloyd's writing partner for a bit. They were at Cambridge together. Rowan and I were at Oxford, slightly different times.
Oh my goodness.
And so I met them all up in Edinburgh in the 1970s when we were students or post students. Douglas and I shared an agent, Jill Foster, in London, a small boutique agency. And John said, Douglas was hopeless at everything except having brilliant ideas. It's great. And when Hitchhiker, he couldn't finish the scripts for Hitchhiker, which is a TV series. He called John in. They did the last two scripts in 2 weeks. And then Douglas fired him. So John was pissed off, and he's perfectly happy about it now. And then, says, well, I'd left radio, went off to do TV. I had fed up with the radio, and hence not the 9 o'clock news.
Which, yes, and folks, all these things, I'll try and put some links in the show notes. I will definitely put a link to the YouTube version of The Schoolmaster.
Well, make sure it's the original one, because it became the encore piece of Rowan's show. He had to do it.
Right.
He kind of got fed up with doing it after years and years of it.
Well,
and
like thought, you do.
And,
like
and
you
then
do.
he yeah. and then he and maybe with Richard wrote another rude version without actually consulting me. When I found out about it, I said, oh, excuse me. And they said, oh, sorry. And anyway, they generously gave me half the royalties, so I got money for doing nothing. I would have liked the chance to write it myself, but they did a rude version, which is not me. So make sure you get the original from the Secret Police.
Cool. Thank you, Richard, for telling me that, because you could just go buy the first one you find, and it may not be the correct one. So I will check that. And gosh, Douglas Adams, I can say, gone too soon, of course.
Oh,
and,
yeah,
but
much missed.
I'm a big fan of this whole era, and you here you are at the, as they say, at the, you know, in the beginning of all this wonderful era of British comedy. And I have to ask you something. Are you familiar with Key and Peele, the American?
No.
They're African American. Comedians, and they had a show for a while.
Was that Jordan Peele?
Yes, and
he became a film director.
And Keegan-Michael Key.
Well, it's Key, right? Of course.
And they had they had a sketch show, and there is a sketch. It's the substitute teacher. But he's doing the reading the role.
Yeah.
But he's mispronouncing all the names because it's kind of an African, it's a take on African American.
Oh, I've read about
name.
That. That's lovely. I mean, look, my idea is, although it came to me originally, I realized afterwards, Spike Milligan did the list of the Huntingdonshire cabmen, read by Sir Michael Redgrave, just reading a list of Huntingdonshire cabmen, which kind of dates it. The only one I remember is Dog Basket Rex, whoever he was.
Well,
a list of names is not a particularly original idea. It just, why does it, originality is important, but it can be overrated if
I
you're
think
doing something that people can't recognize.
Well, Hugh Laurie had read a line in Blackadder, and I just remember his character was written. It was the last season. He was reminiscing about Friends, and he said, "It's strangely brown," and I just started dying because the names are incredibly funny. But I mean, you got to give yourself a little more credit there.
Oh, I'll take all the credit you want to give, but I just don't want to sound like I once was in a room with Charles Aznavour, and someone asked him what were his influences. That old question. He said, "Well." It is impossible for anyone to emerge fully formed from the forest. We are all products of the others. As I'm a product of Tolkien and Ovid and Metamorphoses and the Arabian Nights and the Arthurian legends. And, I can go on in my fantasy writing. We're all ploughing the same furrow. We're all working in the same historical and cultural background. I mean, Tolkien was actually a student at my own Oxford College, 100 years before I was, studying English literature, learning English language, and he was a great scholar of what we now call Anglo-Saxon. I mean, orcs weren't invented by Tolkien; they're in Beowulf.
Right. Yep. Exactly. Yeah. That confused me as a lad because I played Dungeons and Dragons in junior high, and I read that piece, and I said, hang on now. Where did that? Yeah, because when you're young, you start pulling that together, and you start realizing.
You start.
No.
That's right, and that's one of the things I do in my books. There's always puzzles in there and stuff that, the heroes are groping their way through, and bits of the puzzle fit together, and the other bits are just missing. So, and that's what you do when you're learning about your culture as a kid. You fit, and they go, "Oh, that makes. I see. That's Wow, I didn't know that. That word comes from the French, that word comes from the German. They just sound like each other, but oh, I see.
It's so wonderful to make those connections. And even as an
Yes.
adult, you know, and an old man that I am, reading stuff like your stuff. And let's talk about that. Folks who are listening, you're not seeing, but Richard's speaking to us, and you're wearing basically a gamer's headset.
This is a gamer's headset. Yes, my the PR people from the publishers is slightly, they don't say this, but since I started writing the book, I haven't been able to play any games. I'm just so busy writing my books. And then they say, no, you can't say you're a retired gamer because, you know, there are a lot of people interested in the rise of the older gamer and how not everyone online is kids. And that's a very, very interesting topic to talk about. So then, of course, thanks to them, I switched on and started playing a game recently. I can't put the bloody thing down or do any writing. It's just they eat you alive. But anyway, I'm on the book five now, and I've done four in the series. They did come out of my love of role-playing games, but they're not written about games. It's just three people win the world championship, and then the next thing you know, the hero, who's a retired school teacher, by the way, bit like me or my dad, living all alone by himself, discovers he loves online gaming and has got friends all over the world. The two best friends are an Australian orc, the avatar of an Australian guy, and an Asian American dual wielding sword dancer girl, who he assumes in real life is Asian American, but they never talk about themselves. Anyway, they win the world championship of sword and sorcery online, and the next thing he knows, he's standing in a field armed with a crappy sword and shield, and he's for real. He's his own avatar, for real. And there's a reason for it. It's not in a game. It's actually as a zapped off to a new world story. And then the adventure continues. Of course, everything gets worse. He gets captured and sold. Anyway, trains up and eventually gets good and finds the others. And the story can, and then there's a massive, great problem to solve. And then the next book, there's another one. And
It's
the
good, yeah.
next one.
Well, that's the thing. There was kind of a, and I'm sorry if I drop little pop culture references, but there's a little bit of Last Starfighter there. Then there's a little bit of Magnificent Seven there. There's the coming together, and then like you said, the hero's journey times three, and then they come together to solve these big problems. And the fun is the ride, is the journey.
Absolutely. And someone says in one of the books, oh, it's not the ride, it's not the journey, it's the destination. And the answer is it's both. You have to know what's going to, and you know, beginnings are slow, endings are fast. They happen all at once. I'm quoting from the book now. Yes, it's got to be familiar to some extent. Otherwise, people, you know, if I was to write what's called a brilliant novel about two rocks sitting in a cupboard, you know, we wouldn't get it. It might be the best thing ever written, but it would mean nothing to us. So the hero's journey, the adventures, and of course, from my background, a lot of comedy. There's a lot of absurdity because comedy and adventure are natural fits. Comedy is all about fear and pain and misery and things going wrong and disasters and betrayals and confusions and falling into puddles. And what adventure isn't full of those?
If I may, because you brought it up about comedy, I'm just forgive me if this sounds too egghead of you a question, but you, back to the schoolmaster for one second. There's a line in there that Atkins delivers just drolly beautifully as he always. He said, "Yes, isn't life tragic?" And I'm curious.
Yes, isn't life
Isn't
tragic?
life tragic? Yes, and I'm curious. There's an old saying: tragedy plus time equals comedy.
Oh,
Now,
yeah.
so
Com
is that true?
well, it can be. I mean, if you want a definition, tragedy is comedy speeded up. I'm not sure how useful that is, except to show that the structure of all stories is the same. Story structure, which I prefer to call plot structure because stories are limited and plot is infinite. Nobody's written my plot, even though other people have written my story of people going off and having an adventure. Lawrence Kasdan said there are only two stories, not five, which is somebody comes to town or somebody goes on a trip. So what? There are millions and millions of plots. Nobody's written your plot. Nobody's written your guy coming to town. Nobody's written your people going on a trip. So it's very important to be able to distinguish between the two of them.
Richard, I'm thinking to my own novels, and I just realized I've never been told that. That and the
Nobody.
other, they're all about those two things.
I've been telling people this definition. Somebody else came up with it, a screenwriter. I think the guy who wrote McCabe and Mrs. Miller, but I could be wrong. He was the one who defined story as being emotional, generic, and constant. So The Lord of the Rings is always the story of Frodo, the little guy with the big burden. And plot is physical, specific, and never changing. So Frodo is this specific little guy with this specific big burden. And it's physical. He's one moment he's here, and one moment another time he's down in Moria, and then he's at Mordor. So it's a very useful definition for a writer to go, oh, okay. And a plot structure, working out the plot, is very, very important. You've got to let the story tell you what it is. I create my outlines for the books at the same time as I'm writing them. So I'm both inside it, you know, flying by the seat of my pants, as they say, and outside it, pulling focus, looking down and seeing, okay, well, what does it need? What's it trying to tell me? Where does this lead? And that means I'm perfectly prepared to throw lots and lots of pages away. I'm just throwing a lot of pages away in book five because the story doesn't need what I was. I mean, you try things and you see. Philip Pullman said you should, you know, you've made a commitment to write 500 words a day, sit down and write them,
right?
Which is okay for in general, but here's the get out. You can always throw them away if they're no good. I write at night instead of playing role-playing games now. And if they're no good the next morning, I just quietly junk them and go, well, that didn't work. What's the story trying to tell me? It's not what you want. When I'm working as an editor with people, especially inexperienced writers, and I say, well, why is this there? And they say, well, because I like it. I say, well, I don't care what you like. What does the story like? You know, it doesn't work. And if they're inexperienced, they quite often get quite upset because they like it. I said,
right.
Well, put it in another story where it works.
Yeah.
You know, you can always keep it, but you have to get out of your own way.
Yeah. Stephen King said, you have to kill your darlings. There's stuff you
and
love.
That's a well-known phrase. Yeah, I kind of don't really like it because it sounds like you're killing one of your characters that you like. which only George Martin dare. No, other people dare do it, but that the bravery George Martin had in Game of Thrones to kill Ned Stark was astonishing, to kill off your hero right at the beginning.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, that's great. That's a great leap of daring.
Indeed. Well, let me ask you, though, what was the gateway drug, so to speak, for gaming? How did you get into gaming in the first place?
Oh, wow. Probably through poker, believe it or not. Do you know Not the 9 o'clock News? Did you ever hear that?
But
Okay.
I've seen it, yeah.
Well, Mel Smith was a contemporary of mine, a dear friend. He was a heroic gambler. His father was a bookmaker in London, illegal, several booking shops, betting shops. And Mel taught me how to play poker. One day he and his mate David Tupman took, you know, a massive amount of money. I completely misread what David was doing, and he was all over me. Anyway, I wrote a check shaking for some enormous amount of money, like £17, which was like 2 weeks living money in those. And Mel took it and looked at it and said, can you afford this, Richard? And I said, well, yeah, it won't bounce. It'll be all right. It'll be fine. Just don't leave it a day or two before you put it in the bag. And he said, oh. Then he just looked at it and tore it up, handed it back to me and said, well, don't do it again. That was Mel. You could never pay for anything when Mel was around.
Wow.
Anyway, so he once said to me, if you want to make money gambling, own a casino, which is a good way of looking at it. Anyway, I fell in love with poker and online poker. Wrote a couple of books about it. I don't know if they're still in print. One of them was, you know, quite interesting because I interviewed, you know, people who ran a cheating ring and things like that.
Ooh.
So about the poker world. There's my adventures in the World Series of Poker. I got a world champion to teach me and actually won a satellite to get into the main event, which was nice. So that was one. And then, so seeing these online poker games, I realized, well, there are other games out there. And then seeing my daughter and her friends discussing World of Warcraft.
Mm-hmm.
One day I thought, that sounds interesting.
Yeah.
And I go, what are they, you know, the game? Douglas was totally into video games and he died in 98, I think.
Right.
I said, why, you know, what's interesting about these? He said, oh, they're great. I love them. But he was always ahead of his time, Douglas, you know. So I came along later. And once I discovered online gaming, role playing, that's why New Rock, New Role, ROLE is the pun.
Right.
I just adored it. And they're not all, most of the ones I like are Sword and Sorcery or Magic Worlds or Outer Space. I'm not into FPS, first person shooters.
Yeah.
Those are just target practice. And I don't, you know, being not a teenager anymore, I don't have the physical coordination to be fast enough to outshoot people in Fortnite and that sort of thing. Not just not interested in killing people, really.
Yeah.
Although once you go on a mad quest in a mad world, you have to deal the punishment. I just love wandering around these beautiful worlds, and now to be writing about them. I've got my own world, and the thing about role playing games is there are only two quests: go kill something or go fetch something. Kill or FedEx, we call it. But if you're writing a book, you can do a "What the hell is the quest?" quest,
Right.
and they're trying to discover what is going on, not in the particular, not just in the particular story that they're in at the moment, but in the overall story of how they got there and why, which is all explained. And then it's set up for the sequels,
Did
so
you
it's more open. Go ahead.
did you actually ever though play like an RPG in real life, or was it always strictly online?
Well, strictly online, I've been to some conventions now, and I really enjoy them. I'm going to Seattle next month, which I understand is a very good lot of cosplay there. And we had at the book launch in London, we had three people cosplaying. We had an orc and an Asian American sword dancer, and somebody pretending to be Dax, the hero, who's a
Great
heroic young
photo.
battle mate.
Just a great photo on your blog
Thank
of that. I
Thank
love
you.
that. You seem to it seems to be that fun follows you. It seems as though, you're a comedy writer, but you seem very energized by interaction with people. Gaming online, you're interacting with people, just not hand to
Oh,
hand.
yeah.
Is this just a byproduct of your talent and your creative wants, or did gaming bring this out in you a little bit? How do you
I
feel?
think both. I remember somebody who was a revolting person at school, who's so funny. I just thought, I want to be like, I don't want to be as cruel as him.
No.
And he turned out to be delightful in real life. Once we, adolescent kids are one thing, adults are another. So when we met later, we were actually at the same university. And a friend of mine said to, he had a very drawly voice, this guy. I said, "William, I gather you were Richard's worst enemy at school." And he, William said, "I wasn't Richard's worst enemy. I was everybody's." Was he perfect? So, that inspired me to, I thought comedy's great. And my dad, God bless him, took me to see first Marx Brothers film in a
Wow.
cinema in Cheltenham. And I just fell off the chair laughing.
Yeah. I'm a big Marx Brothers fan myself.
Oh,
But there's a big argument in my cohort. Three Stooges or Marx Brothers. I'm like, there's nothing witty about the Three Stooges in my opinion.
well, it's like Buster Keaton or Charlie Chaplin. I mean, clearly Keaton and the Marx Brothers. Again, on my father, when I told him I was going to marry an American, he said, "Well, I suppose the country that gave us Groucho Marx and Louis Armstrong can't be all bad."
I love it. I
And he
love
loved
it.
Jenny, my wife. But two great Americans right there.
Right there.
Yeah.
Well, just what about though that epic fantasy has seen, we've had a lot of guests on our show who write epic fantasy, and it's really seen a resurgence with readers and gamers alike immersing themselves, as you talk about, in these very expansive, detailed worlds. So when you crafted New Rock, New Roll, how did you aim to contribute or differentiate your work within this genre? Do you think what differentiates it? Is it your humor? Is it just because to me it reads very, there's a lot of dialogue here, which I love. It's to me it reads not quite like a screenplay, but I love all the dialogue. Tell me about that.
I love dialogue in books as well, and dialogue is something I've been doing for a long, long time. It comes naturally to me, and it brings scenes alive when you get people talking and at cross purposes, especially in, what there's that wonderful scene where Ola is critiquing the poem that the stable boy gave to Esmeralda, the beautiful young noble maiden that they run away with, he's given her this god-awful poem, which they read, and Ola thinks it's fabulous because everything rhymes, and she thinks it's rubbish. "It's drivel," she says. And there's a complete cross. It's no, it's really good. It's got twas in it. Proper poems have twas in them. And all that. Anyway, so when you get stuff like that happening in the middle of an adventure, it really colours it all up. And it's a chance to just relax and let loose. And why go to a whole new world and just gallop through it? Why not wallow? I love a book where I think, I can't wait. How does this turn? I can't wait to find out how it turns out. I don't want this ever to end. And then I go back and reread them. They're like comfort food. And you go back, "Oh, I want to read that again. That was really good." And you start reading, and then before you know it, you're hooked. And that's what I love about it. And funnily enough, with New Rock, New Roll, this is blowing my own trumpet, but I apologize. When I go back into the earlier books to find out what's to lay pipe and that I pay off in later books, I've got to find out details that I've set up that pay off in later stories. I often find myself not just going to the place to see how how I did it, what the thing is that I need to talk about. But just reading another 20 or 30 pages, because I'm enjoying it so much. And in an odd way, I really wish someone else had written these, because then there'd be 20 more of them and I could read them. It's, at the moment they're only four and a quarter. So.
It's a great feeling. I've picked up some of when I my series, I go back and reread at least the previous one to make sure I get everything right, right? Because it's easy to lose track. And when I find a few lines there, I'm like, wow, I actually wrote that. That turned out. I like that. And then I enjoyed it. It's a great feeling, you know?
It is the best. It's a, and I've had the other side of it. I once wrote a book that I stopped halfway down page 385, thinking in the middle of a sentence, I think, I just gets fed up. Who the hell will want to read this? As trying to write the wrong sort of book.
Right.
I think I used to say I wrote the sort of books I didn't want to read and read the sort of books I didn't want to write. All part of the learning process.
Yeah.
I think I was trying to write, I don't know, some wrong kind, the wrong kind of genre. This is New Rock, New Roll Fantasy is absolutely where I belong. It fits like a glove for me. And once I get writing, it flows very easily. And I just can't wait to find out what they're going to get up to next.
It's terribly evident you're having fun. That's the thing that I love about that too. And there's just this wonderful sense of it all. And listeners, there'll be a book cover you can see. I just love the way they're all falling into the world and the look. I mean, just I remember when I pulled this out of the box. I said, oh my gosh, look at this. This is fantastic.
I'll pass that on to Christina Mervold, who's the, she's the artist. She's a Norwegian girl who lives in Glasgow, Scotland.
Oh my.
And so Worldcon this year is in Scotland, so I'll actually get to meet her. And she's just done the cover for the book two, New Rock, New Realm, which is completed. It's absolutely stunning. But that, we talked about the scene and setting it up, and she's just made it absolutely marvelous. Just that cover says this is fun.
It
And
does.
it really, if I let you down after a cover like that, I would be disappointed in myself. But
I was just
she's
thinking that.
brilliant. Yeah.
I was just thinking she's yeah, you've gotta keep up. It's a high bar with this cover. It's
Yes.
wonderful.
Yeah.
My 15-year-old daughter, who doesn't actually read a lot of this kind of thing, she actually picked it up. She saw it on the table and said, oh, what, this looks interesting. I said, it is.
Oh.
She wanted, in the time we have left, I know we're
Well, I got my test readers. The oldest one is 84.
Oh
And
my.
the youngest is 12, and he's a neighbor in London. I think he's going to be 30. He's a precocious 12-year-old. He came to the book launch and had a lovely battle with the orc with a rubber sword and a rubber battle axe. Milo, having the time of his life. And anyway, he'd been pestering me after. He said, "It's great, it's brilliant, blah, blah, blah. Can I read the sequel? Can I read the sequel?" As was my assistant. And I said to her, "No, you've got to be in the same place as anyone else so that when people write in saying what's going to happen next, you don't know. You could say, well, I think I've got some." Anyway, so I gave them both the sequel for Christmas. And I
Oh.
just got Milo's book report on that. And it's a big thumbs up. Can't publish it yet because the book's not published until November.
Is there something, is there a frontier? I mean, I know you're having a blast doing what you're doing. Is there any, because I just think about you and your life and your career. I mean, you've obviously your incredible beginnings, your work in television, you've basically done it all. Are you a type of person where you're most happy and most enthusiastic about the thing that's right in front of you, or do you look back on your TV work and some of your other stuff and think, ah, I missed that?
I definitely what I'm writing now going forwards. I've done that. That's all done. I mean, what a privilege it was to adapt an Isabel Allende short story for an opera at the Los Angeles Opera, composed by Lee Holdridge, conducted by Placido Domingo. I mean, and I directed that as well.
Oh.
I'm very happy with it, but I'm more interested in what I'm going to write tonight and keeping this flow going. I mean, I've found my bliss as a writer. I've often said to young writers, invent a detective and write 50 stories for him or her, and you're away. And I've spread myself very thin in my career doing operas and songs and books and this and mainly scripts and plays. And to actually focus on narrative fiction is what I've always wanted to do. And I finally got it right. And I can say that because I've got a drawer full of ones that weren't good enough. And I'm glad they weren't published because they're not up to the standard. And I would, they would have paled by comparison. And just to have the chance to do this, I'm so incredibly grateful to do it. And it is, as you say, fun. It's not always easy. I'm
No.
really struggling with book six at the moment because book five, what happened to book five? But I hope I can pull it off. I've completed four. We're in the edit of book two at the moment with my brilliant editor, Leslie Robin. And I just want to keep going forwards, as the characters say in the books.
Does it lend itself to a streamer or a movie even or a series?
Well, I've sold the film rights to a friend I know in London who's a producer, and I've written a screenplay for him. Kind of an interesting story because I thought, well, there's so much going on. It's got to be a series. And he said, well, the streaming world's changed a bit. People actually just want a good 2 hour adventure rather than a long-winded thing that goes on forever. He said, do it like Dune, do it in two parts. So I drafted it and I did the screenplay in one half. And then we had a meeting a few weeks later. And I said, look, come on, Dune's a classic. Nobody's ever heard of me or this book. It's very cheeky to say, come and see part one of something. And then part two comes in. I said, let me see if I can get it all into one and just drive the story through. And I did that. And the whole screenplay is 121 pages, which is a minute a page. And that was nice. So that's ready to go once he gets it together. But it doesn't mean anything. And, movies and TV, you need 200 yeses. People have to keep saying yes, one no, and it's over. I mean, we've got a producer, he's got a script, he's got access to financing. We'll see.
And there's, and of course, there's always development hell and all that stuff too. You
Well,
can't
that's
hit.
been done because we're all on the same side. The script's done. I can now get on with the books. All I want to do is keep writing these stories. If I can get my 500 words a page, 500 words a day done, like Philip Pullman suggests, I'm usually happy at the end. If I don't do any writing, I feel weird.
I understand, and that's I love guests and listeners will know this. I love guests like yourself who anticipate the last question. I don't usually have a, like a Proust questionnaire or last question, but I always love to ask an accomplished person like yourself. What advice do you give to the newbies who are out there listening? But you've already given it. Just get. I always say this: get your butt in the seat and write something. Like you said, it's not always going to be grand, but write.
Yeah, and that is only helpful up to a point when people say that. Absolutely, of course, you have to do it, but inspiration is as likely to strike at your computer as anywhere else. I do most of my inspiration at the computer, but take the dog for a walk. I don't even have a dog. Take an invisible dog for a walk. And then when you're not looking at this page, ideas come from outside because inspiration, the word means breathing into, not inhaling. Breathing into, it means the God breathing into your ear, the muse, the inspiration is breathed in. So it comes from outside. And you've got to be open for that. And sometimes if you're focused on a screen or a page, you're narrow. Bertrand Russell, the great philosopher, if I got a minute, I can tell you this. He was once asked how he solved mathematical problems that he had to do. He's a great mathematician. And he said, well, he studied hard for 48 hours and then put it away for months until it c came time to do the presentation. And then before the presentation, the answer would pop up out of nowhere, unbidden. And he said, this is the line. It is as if orders have been given for the work to proceed underground. It's absolutely brilliant. And that's what's happening with the writer. As Neil Peart, the great drummer of Rush, I love this quote, said, when a writer's staring out of the window, their spouse needs to understand that they're still working. It's continually going on, the work, even though you're not producing the word. So to say, sit down and write, yes, sit down and write, be prepared to throw it away, but also just keep your eyes and ears open and think about it. I look with I with the opera, I had to find how do you sum up obsession in a song? I had this as an obsession moment. And this woman, she'd been raped by the man who killed her father, and she was, she was what, obsessing on this guy. How do I put that in words? There are no words in Isabel Allende's short story. So I went up to bed after breakfast, just lay there in a sort of coma, and then the words stuck. The words came, and then I got day in, day out, night after night. And that was it. The fourth day in, day out, night after night. That's perfect for the musician. It's the same amount of syllable. And I was off to the races, day in, day out. And it ends up as a sextet with every voice on stage singing at the same time. So you just got to honestly just go to bed and relax and turn off the phone and think, what is this story trying to tell me? What does it need? Where are they going? What have I got wrong? Why? And the answer is always not where you're looking. It's either 30 pages ahead or two chapters before, you haven't set it up right. It's not paying off because you didn't set it up right. All stru story structure, plot structure is set up and payoff. That's all that writing is. Set it up, pay it off.
It's fantastic. My grandfather, late grandfather, wrote 33 westerns in his day, and
Whoa.
he always carried a little notebook with him.
Yeah,
And
oh,
right?
absolutely.
Do
Yeah,
you?
absolutely. Yeah, of course. Look, this. I always have one of these with notes
Oh,
scribbled all
fantastic.
over it. There's one in my pocket. I mean, well, it comes out of my note when I'm sitting at the bar in Las Vegas playing video poker and having a beer. Out it comes. Then the next day's work is done.
I was at the Bob Dylan Museum in Tulsa, Oklahoma,
Oh.
and he had a little d Blood on the Tracks, Richard, was
Oh,
written
yeah.
in a notebook that big. Folks, I'm holding up like what, 4 inches, 3 inch
Yeah.
notebook, a little tiny spiral notebook. And you did mention something. I'm a big I go to Vegas. I've been there a million times, and I had no idea. I know it's not for tourists really, it's a locals place, but you have a bar in Vegas, right?
We have two. Yes, they're called Sporting Life Bar. And we just won, I'm very proud of this. Desert Companion is the big magazine in Vegas. And it won Sports Bar of the Year again.
Hey, again.
Sports Illustrated called us one of the 10 best sports bars in America to watch the Super Bowl in. And that's the only one in Nevada, too. I
Well.
just love Nevada. It just happens that, if you have a bar in Nevada, you can have 15 slots in the bar. So the gaming keeps the bar going. People in Vegas love to gamble, and they don't necessarily want to go to the casinos.
Yeah.
Best investment I ever made, and very, very proud of it. I've got two great managers running the business for me.
And you're there periodically? You're not there all the time,
Yeah, I
obviously,
hope
right?
to go out in March for a poker tournament and have a bit of rest and recreation. But again, at night, I'll have my computer, I'll do my 500 words, and we just like it's we're only 4 hours drive away from Vegas. Go and see the bar, go and see the managers, have a business meeting, and then just have some rest and recreation.
Oh, Richard Sparks, you're living the best
Well,
life.
like Mel Smith said, if you want to make money gambling, own a casino. And I do, I own
That's
two.
true. That's true.
Yeah,
Great advice.
very
And
lucky.
listeners, if you want to be entertained, new rock, new roll, Richard Sparks. It is a series. There are more to come, but you've got to catch up on it. It's a beautiful, beautiful volume, as we discussed. It's light in so many ways, as far as the dialogue and fun, what you would expect from a gentleman who's written for Rowan Atkinson and myriad others, I'm sure, that we haven't covered today. But Richard, I'm so touched that you had a moment to share with us about your process and the great advice you gave, and as well as these wonderful anecdotes. I hope you'll consider coming back when the new book's out. We really love meeting you here on the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Alex. I'd love to come back when New Rock, New Realm is published, and I'll give you my Douglas Adams stories instead of the Rowan Atkinson ones.
Oh, I'm going to hold you to it on that, okay? All
Okay.
right. All right. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on Mysterious Goings On. Be sure to follow Mysterious Goings On wherever you get your podcast and never miss an episode. Don't forget, you can get the links to books and other things mentioned on the show at mgopod.com. Until next time, keep reading.